To tell LD, when she'd said goodbye, and it was the last time, it had been really the penultimate time, but that this was the last time. This was goodbye, for real. And get serious weight from Lady Delphina, pay her twice the 8-gram rate as a generous farewell as she walked without much real formality to her tea stop and stood on the platform, each time mistaking little mutters of thunder for the approach of the train, wanting more of it so badly she could feel her brain heaving around in its skull, then a pleasant and gentle-faced older black man in raincoat and hat, with a little flat black feather in the band, and the sort of black-framed styleless spectacles pleasant older black men wear, with the weary but dignified mild comportment of the older black, waiting alone with her on the chill, dim Davis Square subway platform. This man had folded his Herald neatly lengthwise, and had it under the same arm he tipped his hat with, and said to excuse him, if this was an intrusion, he said, but he'd had occasion to see one or two of these linen veils before around, like what she wore, and was interested and rendered curious. He pronounced all four syllables of interested, which Joelle from Kentucky enjoyed. If he might be so bold, he said, tipping his hat. Joelle had engaged with him completely, which was extremely rare, even off the air. She rather welcomed the chance to think about anything else at all, with the train surely never pulling in. She reflected that the anecdote had gotten about, but not the incident's legacy, she said, as if that part were hidden. The Union of the Hideously and Improbably Deformed was unofficially founded in London in B.S. 1940, in London, United Kingdom, by the cross-eyed, palate-clefted, and wildly carbuncular wife of a junior member of the House of Commons, a lady whom Sir Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, having had several glasses of port plus a toddy at a reception for an American lend-lease administrator, had addressed in a fashion wholly inappropriate to social intercourse between civilized gentlemen and ladies. Unwittingly all but authoring the union designed to afford the scopophobic, empathic fellowship, and the genesis of sturdy inner resources through shame-free and unconstrained concealment. Winston Churchill, when the lady, no person's doormat, informed him with prim asperity that he appeared to be woefully inebriated, made the anecdotally famous reply that, while yes, yea verily, he was indeed inebriated, he would the following a.m. be once again sober, while she, dear lady, would tomorrow still be hideously and improbably deformed. Churchill, doubtless under weighty emotional pressures during this period in history, had then proceeded to extinguish his cigar in the lady's sherry and to place a finger bowl napkin delicately over the ruined features of her flaming visage. The laminated non-photo UHID membership card Joelle showed the interested old black gentleman related all this data and more in a point size so tiny the card looked somehow both blank and defaced. Putative curriculum vitae of Helen P. Steepley, 36, 1.93 meters tall, 104 kilograms in weight, AB, MJA. 1 year, time, graduate intern, newsmakers section. 16 months, decade magazine, hottest and nottest, a trends and style analysis column, until decade folded. 5 years, Southwest Annual, Human Interest, Geriatric Medical, Personality and Tourism Articles. 5 months, Newsweek. 11 small features on trends and entertainment, until her executive editor, with whom she was in love, left Newsweek and took her with him. 1 year, Ladies' Day, Personality and Medical Cosmetic Features, some research firsthand, until 1 week in which the executive editor reconciled with his wife, an HPS got mugged and purse snatched on West 62nd and vowed never again to live in Manhattan. 15 months to present, Moment Magazine, Southwest Bureau, Arithema, Arizona, Medical, Soft Sports, Personality, and Home Entertainment Trends Reporting, Masthead Byline, Contributing Editor Status. Thereafter, proceeding first to the Upper Brighton and now the Cooperative Back Bay Edge brownstone she had lived in once with Orrin and performed in with his father, and then passed on to Molly Notkin, today's party's guest of honor and hostess in one. As of yesterday, enjoying ABD predoctoral status in film and film cartridge theory at MIT, having cleared the notorious hurdle of oral examinations on that day by offering her examination committee a dramatically rendered, and, if she did say so herself, devastating oral critique of post-millennial Marxist film cartridge theory from the point of view of Marx himself. Marx, as pretend film cartridge theorist and scholar. Still dressed as Karl Marx a day later in celebration, the glued beard matted and pubic black, Homburg ordered directly from Wiesbaden, soot from a terribly obscure British souvenir filth shop, she has no idea that Joelle's been in a cage since year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, has no idea what she and Jim in Cadenza were even about for 21 months, whether they were lovers or what, whether Orrin left because they were lovers or what, or that Joelle even now lives hand to lung on a grossly generous trust willed her by a man she unveiled for but never slept with, the prodigious punter's father, infinite jester, director of a final opus so magnum he'd claimed to have had it locked away.
80.
Joelle's never seen the completed assembly of what she'd appeared in, or seen anyone who's seen it, and doubts that any sum of scenes as pathologic as he'd stuck that long, quartzy, auto-wobbling lens on the camera and filmed her for could have been as entertaining as he'd said the thing he'd always wanted to make had broken his heart by ending up. Climbing to the third floor, stairs pale from wear, still trembling from the AM's interruptus, Joelle finds herself having a hard time climbing, as if the force of gravity goes up as she does. The party sounds start around the second landing. Here is Molly Notkin, dressed as a crumbling Marx again, greeting Joelle at her door, with a sort of delighted mock surprise U.S. hostesses use for greetings. Notkin secures Joelle's veil for her during removal of the beaded coat and poncho, then lifts the veil slightly in a practiced two-finger gesture to deliver a double-cheek kiss that is sour with cigarettes and wine. Joelle never smokes when veiled. Asking how Joelle got here, and then without waiting for an answer, offering her that odd kind of British Columbian apple juice they'd found they both liked so, and that Joelle at home's abandoned and gone back to the big red soda water of childhood, which Notkin doesn't know, and still cluelessly considers extra sweet Canadian juice to be pretty much both her and Joelle's biggest vices. Molly Notkin's the kind of soul you want desperately to be polite to, but have to hide it with because she'd be mortified if she suspected you were ever just being polite to her about anything. Joelle makes a get-out-of-here gesture. The really, really good kind? The kind that looks muddy, it's so fresh.
Where'd you get it this late, this far east?
The kind you just about had to strain, it's so fresh. The living room is full and hot, campy mambo playing, walls still the same off-white, but all the trim now a confectioner's rich brown. Or, plus there's wine, Joelle sees. A whole assortment on the old sideboard it took three men with cigars and gray jumpsuits to get up the stairs when they got it. An assortment of bottles of different shapes and dim colors and different levels of what's inside. Molly Notkin has one dirty nailed hand on Joelle's arm and one on the head of a chair of Maya Deren, brooding avant-gardedly in vivid spun glass polymers, and is telling Joelle about her orals in a party's near shout that will leave her hoarse well before this big one's sad end. A good, muddy juice fills Joelle's mouth with spit that's as good as the juice, and her linen veil is drying and beginning once again comfortingly to flutter with her breath, and, perched alone and glanced at covertly by persons who do not know they know her voice, she feels the desire to raise the veil before a mirror, to refine some of her purse's untouched material, raise the veil, and set free the encaged, rapacious thing inside to breathe the only unclothed gas it can stomach. She feels ghastly and sad, She looks like death. Her mascara's all over the place. No one can tell. The plastic Pepsi bottle and glass cigar tube and lighter and packet of glycine bags are a shape in the corner of the rain-darkened cloth purse that rests on the floor just below her dangling clogs. Molly Notkin is standing with Rutherford Keck and Crosby Baum, an erratically bad-postured man before the school-supplied Infernitron viewer. Baum's wide back and pompadour obscure whatever's on the screen. Academics' voices sound nasal, with a cultivated stutter at sentences' start. A good many of James O. Incandenza's films were silent. He was a self-acknowledged visual filmmaker. His damaged, grinning boy, Joel, never got to know, because Oren had disliked him, often carried the case with the lenses, grinning like somebody squinting into bright light. That insufferable child actor, Smothergill, used to contort his face at the boy, and he'd just laugh, which sent Smothergill into tantrums that Miriam Prickett would resolve in the bathroom somehow. An old Latin Revival CD issues at acceptable volume from the speakers screwed into planters and hung with thin chains from each corner of the cream ceiling. Another large loose group is dancing in the cleared space between the cluster of directorial chairs and the bedroom door, most favoring Year of the Depend adult undergarments Minimal Mambo, this autumn's East Coast anti-craze, the dancers appearing to be just this side of standing still, the subtlest possible hints of fingers snapping under right-angled elbows. Oren Incandenza, she has not forgotten, had a poor, mottled, swollen elbow above a forearm the size of a leg of lamb. He had switched neatly from arm to leg. Joel was Oren Incandenza's only lover for 26 months and his father's optical beloved for 21. A foreign academic with an almost Franciscan bald spot has the swirling limp of someone with a prosthesis, hired by MIT after her time. The better dancers' movements are so tiny they are evocative and compel watching, their near-static mass curdled and bent somehow, subtly around one beautiful young woman, quite beautiful, her back undulating minimally in a thin, tight, blue-and-white-striped, sailorish top as she alludes to a cha-cha with maracas empty of anything to rattle, watching herself almost dance in the full-length mirror of quality plate that after Oren left, Joel had forbidden Jim to hang and had slid beneath her bed face down. Now, it's the west wall's framed mirror, hung between two empty ornate gilt frames. Notkin thinks she's been retro-ironic by having the frames themselves framed, in rather less ornate frames, in wry allusion to the early experialist fashion of making art out of the accessories of artistic presentation. The framed frames, hanging not quite evenly on either side of the mirror he'd cut for the scenes of that last, ghastly thing he'd made her stand before, reciting in the openly empty tones she'd gone on to use on air. The girl stands, transfixed in alternating horizontal blue and white, then vertically sliced by bar-cut sunlight, diced, drunk, so wrecked on good vintage her lips hang slack and the reflected cheeks' muscles have lost all integrity and the cheeks jiggle like the outstanding paps in her little sailor's top. Apocalyptic rouge and a nose ring that's either electrified or is catching bits of light from the window. She is watching herself with unselfconscious fascination in the only serviceable mirror here outside the bathroom. This absence of shame at the self-obsession. Is she Canadian? Mirror cult? Not possibly a UHID. The bearing's all wrong. But now, whispered to by a near motionless man in an equestrian helmet, she turns abruptly, falling away from her own reflection to explain, not to the man so much as no one in particular, the whole dancing mass. I was just looking up my tits, she says, looking down at herself. Aren't they beautiful? And it's moving. There's something so heartbreakingly sincere in what she says. Joel wants to go to her, Tell her it is and will be completely all right. She's pronounced beautiful, like the earlier interested, in four syllables, splitting the diphthong, betraying her class and origin, with the heartbreaking openness Joelle's always viewed as either terribly stupid or terribly brave. The girl raising her striped arms in triumph, or artless thanks, for being constructed this way. These tits, built by whom and for whom never occurring, artlessly ecstatic. She is not drunk, Joelle now sees, but has taken ecstasy, Joelle can see. From the febrile flush, and eyes jacked so wide you can make out brain meat behind the ball's poles, also known as X or MDMA, a beta something, an early synthetic, emotional acid, the love drug, so-called, big among the artistic young under, say, Bush and successors, since fallen into relative disuse because its pulverizing hangover has been linked to the impulsive use of automatic weapons in public venues. A hangover that makes a freebase hangover look like a day at the emotional beach. The difference between suicide and homicide consisting perhaps only in where you think you discern the cage's door. Would she kill somebody else to get out of the cage? Was the allegedly fatally entertaining and scopophiliac thing Jim alleges he made out of her unveiled face here at the start of the year of the trial-sized dove bar, a cage, or really a door? Had he even cut the tape into something coherent? There was nothing coherent in the mother-death cosmology and apologies she'd repeated over and over, inclined over that auto-wobbled lens propped up in the plaid-sided pram. He never let her see it, not even the dailies. He killed himself less than 90 days later. Fewer than 90 days? How much must a person want out to put his head in a microwave oven? A dim woman all the kids had known of in Boaz had put her cat in a microwave to dry it after a tick bath and set the oven just on defrost, and the cat ended up all over the woman's kitchen's walls. How would you rig the thing so it would activate with the door open? Is there some sort of refrigerator light button you could hold down and secure with tape? Would the tape melt? She cannot remember thinking of it once in 4 years. Did she kill him, somehow, just inclining, veilless, over that lens? The woman in love with her own breasts is being congratulated with the subtlest possible allusions to clapping hands from barely animate dancers with their glass tulips held between their teeth. And Vogelsong of Emerson College tries suddenly to stand on his head and is immediately ill in a spreading plum-colored ectoplasm the dancers do not even try to evade the spread of. And Joelle applauds the ecstatic woman as well, because they are, Joelle admits freely, the paps. They are attractive, which in the union is designated compelling within compatible relative limits. Joelle has no problem seeing beauty approved within compatible relative limits. She feels not empathy or maternal nurture any longer, just a desire to swallow every last drop of saliva she will ever manufacture and exit this vessel, have 15 more minutes of too much fun, eliminate her own map with the afflatus of the blind god of all doorless cages. And she lets herself slide forward from Melia's lap, a tiny fall, leading with her lumpy purse and glass of mad apple juice toward the door beyond the lines of a becalmed conga and doorwayed huddles of a warm and well-felt theoretical party. And then again delays, dithers, and the easement to the bathroom is blocked. She is the only veiled woman here, and an academic generation ahead of most of these candidates, and rather feared, even though not many know she is an aural personality, feared for quitting instead of failing. And because of the connection of the memory of Jim, and she is given a certain wide social berth, allowed to delay and orbit and stand unengaged at the fringes of shifting groups, obliquely glanced at, veil going concave at each in-breath, waiting with hip-shot nonchalance for the bathroom off the bedroom to clear. Iacarino, the chaplain archivist, and a jaundiced yellow older man have gone into Molly's bedroom and left the door ajar, waiting nonchalantly, ignoring the foreign academic who wishes to know where she works with that veil. Turning from him rudely, brain heaving in its bone box, memorizing every detail like collecting empty shells, sipping cloudy juice under neatly lifted corners of veil, now looking at instead of through the translucent cloth, the improbably deformed equivalent of closing the eyes in concentration, on sound, letting the very last party wash over her, passed gracefully by different mingling guests, and once or twice almost touched, seeing only inrushing and then billowing white, listening to different mingling voices, the way the unveiled young taste wine.
This is a technologically constituted space.
Thing opens tight on Remington in a hideous grandfatherly flannel suit, black and white, straight full frontal shot on this grainy black and white stuff Bouvier taught him to manipulate, the f-stop to mimic that horrid old Super 8, straight full frontal, staring past the camera, no attempt to disguise he's reading off a prompter, monotone and all, saying, "Few foreigners realize that the German term Berliner is also the Vulgate idiom for a common jelly donut." And thus Kennedy's seminal Ich bin ein Berliner was greeted by the Teutonic crowds with a delight only apparently political. At which point he aims his thumb and finger at his own temple, at which point his TA doubles the focal length, so there's this giant...
"I would die to defend your constitutional right to error, friend. But in this one case, you..."
They used to be less beautiful, but then Rutherford said to quit sleeping face down.
No, I'm saying that this whole thing, what you and I are discoursing within, is a technologically constituted space.
"Adieu, nous savons foie au poison."
"It's good cheese, but I've had better cheese."
Man wearing, this is Kirby. Kirby here's in pain. He's been telling me about it, and now he'd like to tell you about it.
Complete mystery why Eve Flum didn't show. It's known she'd re-up for the part. The whole rest of them were there, even Henderson, and that Davis woman is Alice, who had to be wheeled out under nurse's care. My God, and Peter? Looking as if he'd eaten nothing but pastry for the past 40 years. Greg with that absurd hairpiece and snakeskin boots. Yes, but all the kids recognizable underneath somehow this pre-digital insistence on continuity through time that was the project's whole magic and raison. You know this. You're current on pre-digital phenomenology and Brady theory. And then, but now, here's this entirely incongruous middle-aged black woman playing Jan.
"Degustibus non est disputantum."
Balls. An incongruous central blackness could have served to accentuate the terrible whiteness that had been in luck. The entire historical effect of a seminal program was horribly, horribly altered. Terribly altered.
Eisenstein and Kurosawa and Michaud walk into a bar.
"You know these mass-market cartridges for the masses? The ones that are so bad they are somehow perversely good? This was worse than that."
So-called phantom, but real and mobile. First the spine, then not the spine, but the right eye socket. Then the old socket's fit as a fiddle, but the thumb, the thumb doubles me over. It won't stay put. Fucks with the emotions gradient so that all the tesseract's angles appear to be right angles, except in... So what I did, I set up right next to him, you see? So in a sense, he didn't have room to stalk or draw a bead. Keck had said they needed a good 10 meters, so I cocked the hat just so, just ever so slightly, like so, just cocked it over to the side, like so, and sat down practically on the man's knee, asked after his show carp. He keeps pedigreed carp. And of course, you can imagine what...
A more interesting issue from a Heideggerian perspective is a priori, where the space as a concept is inframed by technology as a concept.
It has a mobile cunning, a kind of wraith or phantom-like...
because their emotional more label at that stage.
So get dentures, she said.
So get dentures?
So who shot the incision? Who did the cinematography on the incision?
Way it can be film qua film, Comstock says if it even exists, it has to be something more like an aesthetic pharmaceutical, some beastly post-annular scopophiliacal vector, supra-subliminals and that. Some kind of abstractable hypnosis, an optical dopamine cue, a recorded delusion. Duquette says he's lost contact with three colleagues. He said a good bit of Berkeley isn't answering their phone.
I don't think anyone here would dispute that they're absolutely fetching tits, Melinda.
We had blinis with caviar.
There were tartines. We had sweetbreads and mushroom cream sauce. He said it was all on him. He said he was treating. There was roast artichoke topped with a sort of fly only. Mutton stuffed with foie gras. Double chocolate rum cake. 7 kinds of cheese. A kiwi glacé and brandy and snifters you needed 2 hands to swirl.
That coke-addled fag and his Morris Mini.
The prosthetic film scholar.
Fans do not begin to keep it all in the great convexity. It creeps back in.
What goes around, it comes back around.
This your nation refuses to learn. It will keep creeping back in. You cannot give away your filth and prevent all creepage, no? Filth by its very nature is a thing that is creeping always back.
Me, I can remember when your Charles was café with cream.
Look now at it. It is the Blue River. You have a river outside you that is robin eggs blue.
I think you mean great concavity, Elaine.
I mean great convexity. I know what is the thing I meant.
And then it turned out he'd put ipecac in the brandy. It was the most horrible thing you've ever seen. Everyone, all over, spouting like whales. I'd heard the term projectile vomiting, but I never thought that I... You could aim, the pressure was such that you could aim. And out come his grad technicians from under the tablecloths like overhang, and he pulls out a canvas chair and clapper and begins filming the whole horrible, staggering, spouting, groaning.
This ultimate cartridge's aesthetic death rumor has been going around like a lazy toilet since Dishmaster, for Christ's sake. Simply make inquiries, mention some obscure foundation grant, obtain the thing through whatever shade of market the thing's alleged to be out in. Have a look. See, there's doubtless just high-concept erotica or an hour of rotating whirls. Or something like late Makaveyev, something that's only entertaining after it's over, on reflection.
The striated parallelogram of PM sunlight is elongated in transit across the co-op's eastern wall. Over bottle-laden sideboard and glass cabinet of antique editing equipment, and louvered vent and shelves of art cartridges in their dull black and dun cases. The mole-studded man in the equestrian helmet is either winking at her or has a tic. There's the pre-suicide's classic longing. Sit down 1 second. I want to tell you everything. My name is Joelle Van Dyne, Dutch-Irish. And I was reared on family land east of Shiny Prize, Kentucky, the only child of a low pH chemist and his second wife. I now have no accent except under stress. I am 1.7 meters tall and weigh 48 kilograms. I occupy space and have mass. I breathe in and breathe out. Joelle has never before today been conscious of the sustained volition required to just breathe in and breathe out. Her veil recessing into nose and rounded mouth, and then bowing out slightly like curtains over an open pane.
Convexity. Concavity. Convexity. Concavity, damn your eyes.
The bathroom has a hook and a mirrored medicine cabinet over the sink and is off the bedroom. Molly Notkin's bedroom looks like the bedroom of someone who stays in bed for serious lengths of time.
A pair of pantyhose has been tossed onto a lamp. There are not crumbs but whole portions of crackers protruding from the gray surf of wopsed-up bedding. A photo of the fallow neurotic New Yorker with the same fold-out triangular support as the blank cartridge's anti-ad. A Ziploc of pot and easy widers and seeds in the ashtray. Books with German and Cyrillic titles lie open in spine-cracking attitudes on the colorless rug. Joelle's never liked the fact that Notkin's father's photograph is nailed at iconic height to the wall above the headboard. A systems planner out of Knoxville, Tennessee, his smile, the smile of a man who wears white loafers and a squirting carnation. And why are bathrooms always way brighter lit than whatever room they're off? On the private side of the bathroom door, she's had to take two damp towels off the top of to close all the way, the same rotten old hook for a lock never quite ever seeming to want to fit its receptacle in the jam. The party's music now some horrible collection of mollified rock classics with all soft rock's grim dental associations. The business side of the door is hung with a selective automation of Knoxville calendar from before subsidized time and cutout photos of Kinski as Paganini and Leo as Dwanel, and a borderless still of the crowd scene in what looks like Peterson's The Lead Shoes, and rather curiously, the off-printed image of J. Van Dyne, M.A.'s one and only published film theory monograph.
81.
Joelle can smell, through her veil and own stale exhalations, the little room's complicated spice of sandalwood rubble and a little violet-ribboned pomander and deodorant soap and the sharp, decayed lemon odor of stress diarrhea. Low-budget celluloid horror films created ambiguity and possible elision by putting a question mark after the end, is what pops into her head. The end? Amid the odors of mildew and dicky academic digestion? Joelle's mother's family had no indoor plumbing. It is all right. She represses all pathetic, this will be the last thing I smell thought patterns. Joelle is going to have too much fun in here. It was beyond all else so much fun at the start. Oren had neither disapproved nor partaken. His urine was an open book because of football. Jim hadn't disapproved so much as been vacant with disinterest. His too much was neat bourbon, and he had lived life to the fullest and had gone in for detoxification again and again. This had been simply too much fun at the start. So much better even than nasaling the material up through rolled currency and waiting for the cold, bitter drip at the back of your throat and cleaning the newly spacious apartment to within an inch of its life while your mouth twitches and writhes unbidden beneath the veil. The base frees and condenses, compresses the whole experience to the implosion of one terrible shattering spike in the graph, an inflated orgasm of the heart that makes her feel truly attractive, sheltered by limits, deveiled and loved, observed and alone and sufficient and female. Full, as if watched for an instant, by God. She always sees, after inhaling, right at the apex at the graph's spike's tip, Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa, behind glass at the Vittoria for some reason, the saint recumbent, half supine, her flowing stone robe lifted by the angel, in whose other hand a bare arrow is raised for that best descent, the saint's legs frozen in opening. The angel's expression not charity, but the perfect vice of barb-headed love. The stuff had not just been her encaging God, but her lover, too. Fiendish, angelic, of rock. The toilet seat is up. She can hear a helicopter's chop somewhere overhead east, a traffic helicopter over Starro, and Molly Notkin's shriek as an enormous glass crash sounds off in the living room, imagines her beard hanging aslant and her mouth ellipsed with champagne's foam, As she waves off the breakage that signals, good party, can hear through the door the ecstatic Melinda's apologies and Molly's laugh, which sounds like a shriek.
Oh, everything falls off the walls sooner or later.
Joelle has lifted her veil back to cover her skull like a bride. Since she threw away her pipes and bowls and screens again this AM, she is going to have to be resourceful. On the counter of an old sink, the same not quite white as the floor and ceiling, the wallpaper is a maddening, uncountable pattern of roses, twined in garlands on sticks. On the counter are an old splay-bristled toothbrush, tube of gleam rolled neatly up from the bottom, unsavory old no-coat scraper, rubber cement, Negrum, depilatory ointment, tube of monostat not squeezed from the bottom, phony beard whisker bits and curled green threads of used mint floss and parapectillin, and a wholly unsqueezed tube of diaphragm foam, and no makeup but serious styling gel in a big jar with no lid and hairs around the rim, and an empty tampon box half filled with nickels and pennies and rubber bands. And Joelle sweeps an arm across the counter and squunches everything over to the side under the small rod with a washcloth wrung viciously out and dried in the tight spiral of a twisted cord. And if some items do totter and fall to the floor, it is all right because everything eventually has to fall. On the cleared counter goes Joelle's misshapen purse. The absence of veil dulls the bathroom's smells somehow. She's been resourceful before, but this is the most deliberate Joelle has been able to be about it in something like a year. From the purse, she removes the plastic Pepsi container, a box of wooden matches kept dry in a resealable baggie, two little thick glycine bags each holding 4 grams of pharmaceutical-grade cocaine, a single-edge razor blade, increasingly tough to find, a little black Kodachrome canister whose gray lid she pops and discards to reveal baking soda, sifted fine as talc, the empty glass cigar tube, a folded square of Reynolds wrap foil the size of a playing card, and an amputated length of the bottom of a quality wire coat hanger. The overhead light casts shadows of her hands over what she needs, so she turns on the light over the medicine cabinet's mirror as well. The light stutters and hums and bathes the counter with cold lithium-free fluorescence. She undoes the 4 pins and removes the veil from her head and places it on the counter with the rest of the material. Lady Delphina's little glycine baglets have clever seals that are green when sealed and blue and yellow when not. She taps half a glycine's worth into the cigar tube and adds half again as much baking soda, spilling some of the soda in a parenthesis of bright white on the counter. This is the most deliberate she's been able to be in at least a year. She turns the sink's C knob and lets the water get really cold, then cranks the volume back to a trickle and fills the rest of the tube to the top with water. She holds the tube up straight and gently taps on its side with a blunt, unpainted nail, watching the water slowly darken the powders beneath it. She produces a double rose of flame in the mirror that illuminates the right side of her face as she holds the tube over the match's flame and waits for the stuff to begin to bubble. She uses 2 matches, twice. When the tube gets too hot to hold, she takes and folds her veil and uses it as a kind of oven mitt over the fingers of her left hand, careful, from habit and experience, not to let the bottom corners get close enough to the flame to brown. After it's bubbled for just a second, Joelle shakes out the matches with a flourish and tosses them in the toilet to hear that briefest of hisses. She takes up the black wire prod from the hanger and begins to stir and mash the just bubbled stuff in the tube, feeling it thicken quickly and its resistance to the wire's tiny circles increase. It was when her hands started to tremble during this part of the cooking procedure that she'd first known she liked this more than anyone can like anything and still live. She is not stupid. The charles, rolling away far below the windowless bathroom, is livid blue, more mildly blue, on top from the fresh rainwater that had made purple rings appear and widen. A deeper magic marker type blue below the dilute layer, gulls stamped to the cleared sky, motionless as kites. A bulky thump sounds from behind the large flat-top Enfield Hill on the river's south shore. A large but relatively shapeless projectile of drums wrapped in brown postal paper and belted with twine, hurtling in a broad upward arc that bothers the gulls into dips and wheels. The brown package quickly a pinpoint in the yet hazy sky to the north, where a yellow-brown cloud hangs just above the line between sky and terrain, its top slowly dispersing and opening out, so that the cloud looks like a not very pretty sort of wastebasket, waiting. Inside, Joel hears only a bit of the bulky thump, which could be anything. The only other thing besides what she's about to do too much of here right now she'd ever come close to feeling this way about. In Joel's childhood, Paducah, not too bad a drive from Shiny Prize, still had a few public movie theaters, 6 and 8 separate auditoria clustered in single honeycombs at the edges of interstate malls. The theaters always ended in Plex, she reflected. The This Oplex and That Oplex. It had never struck her as odd, and she never saw even one film there, as a girl, that she didn't just about die with love for. It didn't matter what they were.
She and her own personal daddy up in the front row.
They sat in the front rows of the narrow little over-insulated plexes up in neck-crick territory and let the screen fill their whole visual field, her hand in his lap and their big box of Cracker Jacks in her hand and soda pops secure in little rings cut out of the plastic of their seat's arms. And he, always with a wooden match in the corner of his mouth, pointing up into the rectangular world at this one or that one. Performers, giant, flawless, 2D beauties iridescent on the screen, telling Joelle over and over again how she was prettier than this one or that one right there. Standing in the placid line as he bought the Plex's paper tickets that looked like grocery receipts, knowing that she was going to love the celluloid entertainment no matter what it was, wonderfully innocent, still thinking quality referred to the living teddy bears and Qantas commercials. Standing, handheld, eyes even with his wallet's back pocket bulge. She'd never so much again as in that line felt so taken care of. Destined for big screen entertainment's unalloyed good fun. Never once again until starting in with this lover, cooking and smoking it 5 years back, before Incandenza's death at the start. The punter never made her feel quite so taken care of, never made her feel about to be entered by something that didn't know she was there, and yet was all about making her feel good anyway, coming in. Entertainment is blind. The improbable thing of the whole thing is that when the soda and water and cocaine are mixed right and heated right and stirred just right as the mix cools down, then when the stuff's too stiff to stir and is finally ready to come on out, it comes out slick as shit from a goat. Just an inverted ketchup bottle thump, and out the son of a fucking horse slides. One molded cylinder hardened onto the black wire. Its snout round from the glass tube's bottom. The average pre-chopped freebase rock looks like a 38 round. What Joel now slides with 3 Phillips from the cigar tube is a monstrous white wiener.
A county fair corn dog.
Its sides a bit rough, like mache. A couple clots left on the inside of the tube that are what you forage and smoke before the chore boys and panties. She is now a little under 2 deliberate minutes from too much fun for anyone mortal to hope to endure. Her unveiled face in the dirty lit mirror is shocking in the intensity of its absorption. Out in the bedroom doorway, she can hear Reeves Mainwaring telling some helium-voiced girl that life is essentially one long search for an ashtray. Too much fun. She uses the razor blade to cross-section chunks out of the freebase wiener. You can't whittle thin deli-shaved flakes off because they'll crumble back to powder right away, and they anyway don't smoke as well as you'd think. Blunt chunks are standard operating procedure. Joel chops out enough chunks for maybe 20 good-sized hits. They form a little quarry on the soft cloth of her folded veil on the counter. Her Brazilian skirt is no longer damp. Reeves, Mainwaring's blonde imperial, often had little bits of food residue in it. The ecstasy of St. Teresa is on perpetual display at the Vittoria in Rome, and she never got to see it. She will never again say, "And lo," and invite people to watch darkness dance on the face of the deep. The Face of the Deep had been the title she'd suggested for Jim's unseen last cartridge, which he'd said would be too pretentious, and then used that skull fragment out of the Hamlet graveyard scene instead, which, talk about pretentious, she'd laughed. His frightened look, when she'd laughed, is, for the life of her, the last facial expression memory she can remember of the man. Oren had referred to his father sometimes as himself, and sometimes as the mad stork, and once in a slip as the sad stork. She lights one wooden match and blows it right out and touches the hot black head to the side of the plastic pop bottle. It melts right through and makes a little hole. The helicopter is probably a traffic helicopter. Somebody at their academy had had some connection to some traffic helicopter that had had an accident. She can't for the life of her. No one out there knows she is in here getting ready to have too much. She can hear Molly Notkin calling through rooms about, "Has anyone seen Keck?" In her first theory seminar, Reeves Mainwaring had called one film wretchedly ill-conceived and another desperately acquiescent, and Molly Notkin had pretended to have a coughing fit and it had a Tennessee accent, and that was how they met. The Reynolds wrap is to make a screen that will rest in the bottle's open top. A regular dub screen is the size of a thimble, its sides spread out like an opening bud. Joelle uses the point of some curved nail scissors on the back of the toilet to poke tiny holes in the rectangle of aluminum foil and shapes it into a shallow funnel large enough to siphon gasoline, narrowing its tip to fit in the bottle's mouth. She now owns a pipe with a monster-sized bowl and screen now, and puts in enough chunklets to make 5 or 6 hits at once. The little rocks lie there piled and yellow-white. She puts her lips, experimentally, to the melted hole in the side of the bottle and draws, then, very deliberately, lights another match and extinguishes it and makes the hole bigger. The idea that she'll never see Molly Notkin or the Cerebral Union or her UHID support brothers and sisters, or the YYY engineer, or Uncle Bud on a roof, or her stepmother in the locked ward, or her poor personal daddy again, is sentimental and banal. The idea of what she's about in here contains all other ideas and makes them banal. Her glass of juice is on the back of the toilet, half empty. The back of the toilet is lightly sheened with condensation of unknown origin. These are facts. This room in this apartment is the sum of very many specific facts and ideas. There is nothing more to it than that. Deliberately setting about to make her heart explode has assumed the status of just one of these facts. It was an idea, but now is about to become a fact. The closer it comes to becoming concrete, the more abstract it seems. Things get very abstract. The concrete room was the sum of abstract facts. Are facts abstract, or are they just abstract representations of concrete things? Molly Notkin's middle name is Cantrell. Joelle puts 2 more matches together and prepares to strike them, breathing rapidly in and out like a diver preparing for a long descent.
"I say, is someone in there?"
The voice is the young post-new formalist from Pittsburgh who affects continental and wears an ascot that won't stay tight. With that hesitant knocking of when you know perfectly well someone's in there, the bathroom door composed of 36 that's 3 times a lengthwise 12, recessed 2 beveled squares, in a warped rectangle of steam-softened wood, not quite white. The bottom outside corner right here, raw wood, and mangled from hitting the cabinet's bottom drawer's wicked metal knob. Through the door and offset red, and glowering actors and calendar, and very crowded scene, and pubic spiral of pale blue smoke, from the elephant-colored rubble of ash, and little blackened chunks in the foil funnel's cone. The smoke's baby blanket blue that sent her sliding down along the wall past knotted washcloth, towel rack, blood flower wallpaper, and intricately grimed electrical outlet. The light, sharp, bitter tint of a heated sky's blue that's left her uprightly fetal with chin on knees in yet another North American bathroom. De-veiled, too pretty for words. Maybe the prettiest girl of all time. Prettiest G-O-A-T. Knees to chest, slew-footed by the radiant chill of the claw-footed tub's porcelain. Molly's had somebody lacquer the tub in blue lacquer. She's holding the bottle, recalling vividly its slogan for the last generation was "The choice of a nude generation," when she was of back-pocket height and prettier by far than any of the peach-colored titans they'd gazed up at. His hand in her lap, her hand in the box, and rooting down past candy for the prize. More fun, way too much fun, inside her veil on the counter above her. The stuff in the funnel exhausted, though it's still smoking thinly, its graph reaching its highest spiked prick, peak, the arrow's best descent, so good she can't stand it, and reaches out for the cold tub's rim's cold edge to pull herself up, as the white party noise reaches for her, the sort of stereophonic precipice of volume, to teeter on just before the speakers blow, people barely twitching, and conversations strettoing against a ghastly old pre-Carter thing saying, "We've only just begun." Joelle's limbs have been removed to a distance where their acknowledgement of her commands seems like magic, both clogs simply gone, nowhere in sight, and socks oddly wet, pulls her face up to face the unclean medicine cabinet mirror. Twin roses of flame still hanging in the glasses corner. Hair of the flame she's eaten now trailing like the legs of wasps through the air of the glass she uses to locate the defaced veil and what's inside it. Loading up the cone again, the ashes from the last load make the world's best filter. This is a fact. Breathes in and out like a savvy diver.
"Look here, then. Who's that in there? Is someone in there? Do open up. I'm on one foot, then the other out here. I say, Notkin, someone's been in here, locked in and, well, sounding unwell, amid rather a queer scent."
And is knelt, vomiting over the lip of the cool blue tub, gouges on the tub's lip revealing sandy white gritty stuff below the lacquer and porcelain, vomiting muddy juice and blue smoke and dots of mercuric red into the claw-footed trough, and can hear again and seems to see, against the fire of her closed lid's blood, bladed vessels aloft in the night to monitor flow, searchlit helicopters, fat fingers of blue light from one sky, searching. Enfield, Massachusetts, is one of the stranger little facts that make up the idea that is Metro Boston, because it is a township composed almost entirely of medical, corporate, and spiritual facilities. A kind of arm shape extending north from Commonwealth Avenue and separating Brighton into upper and lower, its elbow nudging East Newton's ribs and its fist sunk into Alston, Enfield's broad municipal tax base includes St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Franciscan Children's Hospital, the Universal Bleacher Company, the Provident Nursing Home, Shuko Mist Medical Pressure Systems Incorporated, the Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital Complex, the Svelte Nail Company, half the Metro Boston turbine and generating stations of Sunstrand Power and Light, the part that gets taxed is in Incorporated Alston, corporate headquarters for the ATH-SCME family of air displacement effectuators, meaning they make really big fans, the Enfield Tennis Academy, St. John of God Hospital, Hahnemann Orthopedic Hospital, the Leisure Time Ice Company, a discalced monastery, The combined St. John Seminary and offices for the RCC's Boston Archdiocese, partly in Upper Brighton, neither half-taxed. Convent headquarters of the Sisters for Africa, the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation, the Dr. George Roebling Runyon Memorial Institute for Podiatric Research, regional shiny truck, lion barge, and catapult facilities for the ONAN-subsidized Empire Waste Displacement Company, what the Quebecois call Lettre Boucher Noir, spectacular block-long catapults that make a sound like a giant stamping foot as they fling great twine-bundled waste vehicles into the subannular regions of the Great Concavity at a parabolic altitude exceeding 5 kilometers. The device's slings are of alloy-belted elastic, and they're huge cupped vehicle receptacles like catcher's mitts from hell. A half dozen or so of the catapults in this blimp, hangarish thing with a selectively slide-backable roof, taking up a good 6 square blocks of Enfield's brachiform incursion into the Alston Spur, occasional school tours tolerated but not encouraged, and so on. With the whole flexed Enfield limb sleeved in a perimeter layer of light residential and mercantile properties. The Enfield Tennis Academy occupies probably now the nicest site in Enfield. Some 10 years after balding and shaving flat, the top of the big abrupt hill that constitutes a kind of raised cyst on the township's elbow. The better part of 75 hectares of broad lawns and clover-leafing paths and topologically cutting-edge erections, 32 asphalt tennis courts and 16 Hartrue composition tennis courts, and extensive underground maintenance and storage and athletic training facilities and briars and calliopsis and pines mixed artfully in on the inclines with deciduous trees. The ETA hilltop overlooking on one side, east, historic Commonwealth Avenue's acclivated migration out of the squalor of Lower Brighton. Liquor stores and laundromats and bars and palisades of somber and guano-dappled tenement facades. The huge and brooding Brighton Project high-rises with 3-story-high orange ID numerals on the side, plus liquor stores and pale men in leather and whole gangs of pale children in leather on the corners and Greek-owned pizza places with yellow walls and dirty corner markets owned by Orientals who try like heck to keep their sidewalks clean, but can't, even with hoses, plus the quarter-hourly trundle and ding of the Green Line trains labor up the avenue's long rise to Boston College, into the spiky elegance of Boston College and the broad gentrification of Newton out to the west, where the haze-haloed Boston sun drops behind the last node in the 4-kilometer sine wave that is collectively called the historic April Marathon's Heartbreak Hill, the sun always setting 15 minutes to the nanosecond after DeLint turns on the court's high tower lights. To, I think it must be the southwest, ETA overlooks the steely gray tangle of Sunstrand's transformers and high-voltage grids and coaxial chokers strung with beads of ceramic insulators, with not one Sunstrand smokestack anywhere in sight, but a monstrous mega ohm insulator cluster at the terminus of a string of signs trailing in from the northeast, each sign talking with many zeros about how many annular generated amps are waiting underground for anyone who digs or in any way dicks around, with hair-raising nonverbal stick figure symbols of somebody with a shovel going up like a Kleenex in the fireplace. There are smokestacks in the visual background slightly south of Sunstrand, though, from the EWD hangars, each stack with a monstrous ATH-SCME 2100 series ADE fan bolted behind it and blowing due north with an insistent high-pitched fury that is somehow soothing, orally, at ETA's distance and height. From both the north and northeast tree lines, ETA looks down its hill's steepest, best-planted decline into the complexly decaying grounds of Enfield Marine. The 5th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The transparent phone sounded from somewhere under the hill of bedding as Hal was on the edge of the bed with one leg up and his chin on its knee, clipping his nails into a wastebasket that sat several meters away in the middle of the room.
82.
It took four rings to find the receiver in the bedding and pull the antenna out.